BFF.fm is an award-winning community radio station.
Okay, good morning. You are listening to TV on the Radio here on BFF.fm. I think the tornado is blowing directly at my microphone, which is what you're hearing. But I'm Leah, and I'm here with Jessica. Good morning, Jess.
Good morning, Leah.
And in the studio today, we have a very special guest, friend of the show, Adam Savage.
Hello.
Good morning. Thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, my God. Well, it just feels like we're continuing. Yes. We all had dinner last night.
We did.
And it just feels like we're continuing the fun, because the last thing we did was leave your house, Leah, and go to bed and woke up and then just came
in. And here we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are we doing later today? Can we go bowling?
I was going to go to the archery range. We got some archery practice last night, and I think we should continue that.
I didn't get one of those suction cup arrows to land.
Ugh. It's the shoddy Chinese archery kit that we bought.
It made me want to build a bow and arrow set that really did use suction cups and was like robust and aimable.
Excellent. Yeah. Savage Bill season two.
Exactly. I'm just going to do a bunch of Bugs Bunny props.
Paint a cave on a wall.
Indeed. Oh, yes. Will magnetic bird seed stop a roadrunner in its tracks?
Well, we're super excited to have you on to actually talk about your show.
Amazing.
We've had you on the show a number of times talking about prestige dramas, and it's delightful to have you on to talk about something that you have created and that I am a huge fan of.
Oh, that's so awesome to hear.
Even if I was not a good friend, I feel like this show is truly just a very personal expression of the joy that you radiate, and your passion for building comes across so clearly in the show. And I was surprisingly touched by a lot of the episodes.
Oh.
And it taught me things about being a builder or a maker that it just seems like this amazingly cool community that, you know, there's this element to building that is deeply like personal, but it's so collaborative. And I think Savage Builds does such a great job at showing like how these things come together. And I was moved by it.
I'd like to give a qualifier here and say that when I talk about making, whenever I'm out doing talks or doing interviews or anything, I really want to say when I talk about making, I'm not also, I'm even though Savage Builds is focused on the physical making of things,
mm-hmm.
I think of making as any time you use your point of view and bring something extant into the world based on that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And so writers, coders, carpenters, dressmakers, everybody who is using their creativity to do something is a maker.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think just that act unites everybody doing something creative.
Yeah.
And it's so delightful to hear you describe the show that way, because that's literally what like our internal team of John, Jackson, Y, and I sat down and were talking about what we wanted this show to feel like and to be like. That
mm-hmm.
was, that's precisely it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Mythbusters. I've loved all your other work, but I think that there's like your point of view comes across so clearly in the show. And one of the things that I've always admired about you is I think you have this like real curiosity about the world and about people. And I think that that is conveyed so well. I think that that's part of being a maker of something is
yes.
like you
yes.
have to have that curiosity. And the show really does a great job at like distilling the process into something that just seems like so joyful and collaborative, and it's just really, really, really amazing.
Well, I got to make it with most of my, a huge portion of my original Mythbusters crew.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks have seen me in every possible kind of day I could ever have, and it's just as thrilled about the whole journey as I am.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was 4.5 months of just repeatedly getting to do those deep dives with my family.
Yeah.
Really.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really came across. And I was my husband and I sat down and watched the first episode, and it's the Iron Man suit. And when Richard Browning comes around the corner on his jetpack,
dude,
it's like one of the most, like, I'm going to sub out delightful for joyful and use joyful 8,000 times in this hour, but it's truly like it lit up that like pleasure center in my brain. I was just like, this is so awesome.
All of us too. No, and Richard is so game to try anything. He's mm-hmm. like, where do you want me? Well, you could come around the corner. He's like, yeah. And then it was like time to put on the helmet of the Iron Man suit. And Richard literally couldn't see. Like, just imagine tying lace over your face and uh-huh. trying to see through the little holes that would remain. That's what Richard could see through that Iron Man mask and still hit his marks. I do have a friend, Mark, who he and I had been corresponding that week that we filmed that final Iron Man flight, mm-hmm. the day of flights at the airport. And Mark and I had been talking back and forth because we had to get together to talk about a project we're working on. And he texted me. That was a Saturday we filmed that. And he's like, hey, are you around today? And I was like, actually, I'm over on the East Bay. Why don't you swing down by the Santa Clara Airport? And I'm shooting, and I think you'll like this shoot. I didn't tell him he'd get to watch an Iron Man suit flying. And in fact, he ended up taking that picture that we used in a lot of the advertising of me with just the Iron Man hand on, mm-hmm. pointed towards the camera. Yeah. That's Mark's photo.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Your joy when you finally mastered it, I teared up a little bit.
Yeah.
It was so palpable.
You know, I was so, when I watched that cut, I saw the look on my face, the sort of almost overly Chris Pratt smile of like the corners of your mouth are going through the roof of your brain.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, and I looked in a mirror and tried to replicate that smile, and it's not possible. It's only possible if I'm seeing 1,000-horsepower jet on my arms helping me fly.
Yeah, it was. It was really, really something. I was like, how do I get this man all my money? Like, Richard Browning,
Oh my gosh. He's trying to, he flies that suit every day in some different part of the world. He's working on competition leagues, and his whole team flies all the time. They just have a pretty awesome life right now.
Yeah, I don't personally want to strap a jetpack on and go flying, but
it's so much fun, and you can totally do it.
I don't know that I could. I think it requires a level of coordination that I am severely lacking.
Coordination, yes.
Yeah.
Strength, no. Strength, it's not as strength-based as I was afraid it would be.
Yeah.
Because I'm not very strength-based.
You mastered it. You told me that he said that you had mastered it faster than anyone else, right?
That's what Richard told me. He might tell that to all his
Everybody
new pilots.
Rides on a
it's just part of his charm.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite episode in this season?
I don't. There are moments.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most number of moments in a single episode came about when we were in New Zealand filming with Peter Jackson's World War I planes.
Mm-hmm.
That episode was, first of all, just being in New Zealand because I love the country, I love the populace, and I have a whole family, effectively, of friends down in Wellington,
mm-hmm.
Near where we were filming, but also because the footage that we were getting from these magnificent planes over the New Zealand landscape is so jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
It was really
oh yeah. my god. I mean, every single time we went up, it was like, okay, let's go up again. And everyone's just beaming.
Take that, Gary Oldman.
And that was also amazing. I mean, Gary, we were trying to bring him up for the shoot to actually be part and parcel of the build.
Mm-hmm.
And scheduling conflicts didn't allow that. But he graciously allowed my son, Thing 2, mm-hmm. to head down to his house, set up a camera on him so we could film that wonderful mm-hmm. conversation. And then, to use a phrase I learned from you, at the end of the, 2 hours we were filming with Gary on that Skype call, my whole crew had hearts coming out of their eyes.
Yeah.
Like, he was so gracious and funny and, engaging with everyone in the room. A lovely maker's maker, you know?
Yeah.
Gary loves building stuff and painting stuff, and we correspond frequently on all of that sort of, on that level.
Mm-hmm.
Delightful and bizarre.
Yeah, that's, I just think the connection is really, palpable, that making something and having this, shared goal, and then the delight that people have when things go right, that 10 arrow in that film.
Dude.
When that worked the very first time, I clapped. I gleefully clapped, and I was not even involved in the whole thing.
Oh, there were so many behind-the-scenes disasters, too, that when those moments happened on camera, all the sensors working on the first try on the Peter Jackson episode, this doesn't ever happen.
Yeah.
When you build a complicated rig, it never works on the first try.
Mm-hmm.
And that one did. Zach Ratting's engineering is so over the top. On the Panjandrum episode, at one point, the Panjandrum fell off of our flatbed and, like, rolled down a road on which there were no cars, thank goodness.
Yeah.
At, like, 4 o'clock in the morning, and we somehow managed to get back on the flatbed and film with it within the hour.
Without ending up on the local news.
One of the things we were like, should we cover this? Should we redo this for camera? Because it's no one would believe that this happened. And yet it did. And everyone's safe and fine.
One of my favorite episodes was the Mad Max melee. Yeah. And part of it is because you had two amazing makers with you, Simone Yurtz and Laura Kampf.
Yes.
I forgot her name. But I love that episode. I love that you chose two female builders to do this extremely physical, like, really, like, yeah, like, balls to the wall, like, Mad Max melee.
Yeah.
And I love that you chose them, and I love, speaking of tearing up, at the end of that episode, Laura said, like, I just love this challenge. I couldn't think of better people to do this with. Like, I love everything that they're doing, and I love their brains. And I was like, that's so amazing. Like, it's so rare that people have that, like, connection where you're like, how beautiful to be lauded for your brain. Like, we should all be so lucky.
And there's an aspect that might not be so obvious, which is they're also, Laura and Simone are both amazing storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
In the medium of making stuff and shooting stories about it, and the same is true for Tori Belleche when he came on for the food fight episode, is that what those folks bring when they come isn't just so a lot of time on the show I was bringing in people who weren't used to being on camera, blacksmith Jeff Pringle and folks like that, and in that you have to be sensitive to how weird and strange it is to have cameras pointed at you while you're trying to do your expertise. And we work really hard to create an environment and build a show structure and give enough time so that the people we bring in can exercise their expertise and don't feel compromised by it. But then there were times when I get to collaborate with people like Simone and Laura and Tori who come not only having all these wonderful engineering chops, but also knowing exactly how to deliver the fun to the camera over the course of the day, how to bring the contrarianness. I love that. I mean, Laura, seriously, by the end of the first day, Simone and I were like, Jesus Christ, Laura's build is so good. It's really pissing us off.
Yeah.
And then Simone going with all static weaponry, which is not something I expected, and I think came quite late. Again, the degree to which that helps inform a really exciting narrative is so delightful that it comes on board with these wonderful creators.
Yeah. It was amazing. My one complaint.
Oh, yeah.
I have one note about that episode.
Okay.
You guys missed a real opportunity when Laura was sitting there and Simone was like, had all the time in the world.
Yeah.
She should have monologued it. It should have been like a baddie in a movie, like where she should have had the internal like monologue. I was waiting for the voiceover track of what would happen.
I will tell you that, like, as a producer and a host, when I'm in a car like that, and you heard me on that episode talking about what I was doing, oh my God, she got me, right? That's my job. Yeah. I have to be doing that the whole time. And it is in the midst of something that much fun, so difficult to remember to talk.
Yeah, of course.
Also, the end of that episode didn't quite go the way it's cut. There's an extra little wrinkle which was that Laura was immobilized and Simone just kept on trying to knock that target. And if you see, she broke the target in half, but there's still a line of copper going across where the target was. So Simone hadn't broken the electrical connection that caused the slime cannon to hit Laura in the face. And so she just kept on going at it for like 5 full minutes. And then I ripped a bit of fascia off the side of my Volvo and holding it like a samurai sword, screamed at the top of my lungs and ran all the way across the tarmac to jump on the hood of Laura's car, taunt her through the window, and then stab the target and watch her get slimed while Simone's arms went up in the air. It was fabulous. And when they cut it, it just made the episode like an extra 3 minutes too long. We had to cut that part out.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yes.
Were there other surprises for you between filming and seeing the edited project?
There always are. There's always things you wish you could get in for time. Extra wrinkles or, you know, you wanted to show how tedious something is. I'm having trouble calling them up right now. Mm-hmm. Because it's a discussion. What are the really important bits? Because you end up with all these little tiny gems mm-hmm. like that. But each one, every now and then, your favorite gem might require an extra 180 seconds of storytelling just to frame it so the audience gets the joke.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to let it go. I really liked when we were doing the Panjandrum. Speaking of sequences that did make it in, I loved the sequence where I'm wiring up all 32 of the igniters mm-hmm. for the rockets and talking about tedium. And we even cut the sequence to be a little tedious.
Like, yeah.
To me, that's I'm giving the visceral understanding of the action.
Yeah, that's awesome. But I really love, was it a conscious decision on your part to have female builders
Absolutely.
Be a huge part of that episode?
Yeah, filled my crew with as many women and people of color, too. Really, it's like, to me, running this show, which is the first time I've done something solo,
mm-hmm.
Was an opportunity to build a crew that looks like the world I want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, absolutely. Laura and Simone were the easiest choices to make mm-hmm. for doing that episode. And again, like, it's not even a point that there are women in the episode, and that's the point.
Yeah, and I love it because it's such a physical, like I said, balls to the wall, like, challenge, and to see these like women just tackle it is really, really inspiring.
So there's this other aspect to them being women that I think made the shoot even better, which is when you're doing something like that, and I know from having done this with Jamie, that smashing cars into each other, like while they're both facing in the same direction, like a sideswipe slash,
mm-hmm.
is one of the most fun things you can possibly do in a pair of cars that aren't yours. And there's also this aspect that once you start to bang cars into each other, it's very easy to go way out of control
mm-hmm.
because it's so much fun. And you start like, well, you know, because the first time I did it with Jamie, I almost immediately pit maneuvered him and sent his car squealing across the runway. And so with Laura and Simone, we were telling them, listen, you know, we're going to creep up on this, but we're going to be banging into each other maybe harder than you think, but it's not going to be as bad as you think. And we're not going to do any T-bones, and we're not going to do any head-on collisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were really assiduous about that, about maintaining that consciousness. I think more than sometimes a man might have been able mm-hmm. to. But there was this moment when I finally, like, skidded in and sideswiped Simone's car, banged right into her really hard, and it jostled her. And I saw her get jostled, shocked, realize that wasn't as bad as she thought it was going to be, and look over with me with this, like, glint of awe in her eyes. And then it was like we'd unleashed the banshee.
Yeah.
And then it was she and Laura and I doing cat and mouse. And, like, once they understood, once they physically got that parameter, it was like, oh, this is so much fun. And then were all these times in which we came right up to each other, but because it was going to be a T-bone or a head-on, we were respectfully staying away from that. We really didn't want anyone to get hurt, but you've got to have as much smashing as possible.
Yeah, that's... sorry, I'm just getting production notes as we're live on the air here.
Stop him from talking too long.
Okay, so mic three is busted. It was not the Vornado.
Oh,
it
here
was,
we go. Here.
It was mic that's three.
Okay. Go ahead.
Fisk and I will share mic two.
So I also, just a little side note, I love how your expert in the Excalibur episode was also a very cute female who I'm like, go find the lady who makes me think I can pull off bangs now. Like, that's...
Oh, and like, she was... This is a lady who works as a blacksmith at the Crucible, so I'm sure she gets like... hammer holding men mansplaining to her on every single day of the week. So she really held her own. She was fabulous.
Yeah. It was really amazing.
What other collections does Peter Jackson have?
So it's funny. He's got a tremendously large collection of World War I uniforms. Mm-hmm. In fact, I pointed out to his archivist, I said, you guys have so much stuff. Where do you get it? He's like, eBay and other places and auction houses. I'm like, really? Because every time I search World War I uniforms on eBay, I don't find anything. And he said, yeah, that's probably because of us.
Thanks, Peter.
He also has one of the most important collections of film props and memorabilia in the world. He's got one of Hal's original eyes. He's King Kong's original armature. Iron Man costumes. Costumes from the original Joan of Arc. I mean... It's an amazing collection, and he is he is wide-ranging in his interests about film costume. I mean, he's got them in the thousands. Mm-hmm. Thousands and thousands. I have 75 costumes in my collection.
Wow.
Like, that's what he's got in the entryway to one of the buildings he stores his costumes in, right?
That's his little throwaway, like, extra 2% exactly. in case everything goes wrong. Also, if you guys would like to join the conversation, if you have some questions for Adam, we would love to hear from you. We are at BFF TV on the radio at Twitter. Feel free to tweet at us if you have some questions. Was there a bill that you proposed that Discovery was just like, no, we're not creating a replica of the Titanic. It's not in the budget. Was there anything that was flat out just shut down?
Yes. One of the builds I wanted to do, I've always been obsessed with dinosaurs. As you know, I have a big T-Rex skull as my pool table light. And I wanted to make a raptor costume, like one of those wear around raptor costumes that Japanese prank shows use on people in offices all the time.
Okay.
So I own one of those costumes. I mean, it's not that great. And I've always wanted to make one that was super realistic and also really compelling and scary in its movements. And I have all these designs for the mechanics. I've talked to the people at Legacy Effects, who originally Stan Winston Effects, that did all the dinosaurs for Jurassic Park. And we've talked about collaborating on this and making it super realistic, but also using only items from a hardware store, right? Like no exotic materials, uh-huh. all really, really mundane, because it's completely possible. And again, to me, this is like letting people know what they could do with just what's at their hardware store. And Discovery really wasn't interested in that. I mean, that's fine. You know, we pitched a lot of ideas they didn't like. They want the bombast. They want the excitement mm-hmm. at the end of the episode. And they had a hard time imagining how scary I might be in a dinosaur costume made from a hardware store. I think maybe saying dinosaur costume hardware store is the thing that they were like, yeah, that doesn't sound that scary. They thought they'd see like plungers for horns.
Yeah. Yeah, this sounds amazing to me. Yeah. I'm here for the plungers for horns.
I will say, when I bought that dinosaur costume that I do have, we put it on at the cave, and there's a children's playground not far from the cave. And so I wandered over to the children's playground, and all of the children at the playground ran towards the dinosaur costume, not afraid at all of being low on the food chain, San Francisco children.
Yeah, absolutely. That's maybe says more about San Francisco than anything else, but yeah.
What are you doing? Run for your lives!
So you mentioned earlier that you did this show, involved a lot of experts in different things.
Yeah.
I love the sword guy.
Yeah, Jeff Pringle.
J.D. Street was a delight.
J.D. Street is, old school. I love that guy.
So he said that, you know, he has to be there legally for before you make a flamethrower.
Yes.
And he said, but, you know, he's not cheap. Well, I have a 7-year-old's birthday party to plan next year. So if we can talk numbers, JD,
if you're willing to fireproof that shed behind your house, I think you might be able to work something out.
Yeah, I think that's a great theme for a San Francisco party. We'll have you in the T-Rex costume and JD Street.
It is. So we've done this now 3 times with JD, filmed with flamethrower stories, 2 on Mythbusters and 1 on Savage Builds. And it's hilarious to me that we filmed 3 episodes on flamethrowers in the most restrictive state in the union for flamethrowers. Yeah. There's literally 2 people in all of California qualified to build and operate and supervise flamethrowers.
Wow.
Yeah, we should be in Texas, where I think like every citizen has a sovereign right
to
a flamethrower.
Yes, you are absolutely assigned a flamethrower at birth. One of the things that I loved is you do incorporate all these experts, and it really struck me that I love that there's like a life out there for people who are like passionate about like medieval swords,
right,
and like this guy can make that his life's work. And it just, we're living in an extremely online world. Mm-hmm. And also, we were talking about this a little bit. I feel like platforms like Twitter can give everyone the opportunity for like a really great hot take, right? Like everybody can be an expert in something, or at least position yourself as an expert just because you can have a good opinion about something. And one of the things I really love about the show is that these people are people who are truly, truly passionate about what they do, and they've made it into like a living. And that's just, it's so rewarding to see people being recognized for actually like putting in the time and the effort and not just like having a hot take about medieval swords, you know? Like,
I totally agree. And you know, it, part of the institutional knowledge that the crew that I've worked with for so many years has is being able to talk to these folks on the phone. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, you're going to be great. Come on this show. Or, you know, just understanding how to create an environment where these folks can come on the show and feel comfortable and that we get to see that glint in their eye. Because it really is. I totally agree with you. It's so inspiring when you find someone who's like, yeah, I build medieval swords and I pay the rent by doing it.
Yeah.
Like that's 10-year-old me would have loved to have known that there were tons of jobs like that out there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the amazing thing is that you do get to see that glimpse of like, oh, this kid was like weird. And then you're like, and he made it work. Like, yeah. That's really amazing and super inspiring. And I think that, you know, we live in a weird area in San Francisco. I saw a tweet, speaking of tweets and hot takes, I saw a tweet the other day that somebody was talking about how he was in town visiting somebody and he was helping them with their deck. And they were like, oh, I didn't know your friend had a company. And he's like, no, physical deck. Like, we live... it's not all startups, guys. But, like, it's really amazing to see that, like... Your life can be carrying around nitroglycerin if that's what you want it to be. It
doesn't have to be. Yes,
now,
it could.
That guy, I would maybe say, go ahead and get a 9-to-5, sweetie. If I was married to him, I'd be like, how about we put away the nitroglycerin for a bit?
I don't ever want to work with nitroglycerin again. Thank goodness. I don't think I have to. The bomb techs are a very fascinating and specific gene pool.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Somebody told Jamie and I years ago, we were filming up in Matsu County, Alaska, in the winter, 40 degrees below zero. Oh, and the police chief there said that when he was a commanding officer in the military, they would give him certain types of people to look for to fill weird, hard-to-fill positions. Mm-hmm. And one of the hard positions to fulfill was bomb techs. And the list of personality traits that as the CO he was given to look for that was like a team player yet can work alone, out-of-the-box thinker, irreverent and often dark sense of humor.
Huh.
These were some of the attributes. And it read like this combination of a description of Jamie Heineman and I.
Yeah.
And because bomb squads are all contingency planners. Their goal is to teach themselves how to deal with something they have no idea about. And that was effectively the working premise of Mythbusters. So we always found, and still do, whenever I work with bomb squads and former and current bomb techs, I find a very simpatico working relationship. Mm-hmm. And I am a lifetime member, lifetime honorary member of the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators.
Oh,
yes.
What? I
got a challenge coin and everything.
I had no idea.
There were a lot of interesting handshakes at that convention. Right? Like
aggro.
Some digits here and there that aren't necessarily all.
Stumped.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Well, speaking of, how do you think tech has changed being a maker? Now that, I mean, people now have 3D printers in their garage, right?
There's been good and there's been bad. A friend of mine who teaches young people in trouble how to cook in order to give them a life skill and mm-hmm. professional skill, he says more and more these days, he's having kids, 18-year-olds show up who have literally never built something, with paper clips and staplers with their hands.
Yeah.
That how rudimentary he has to get to teach them knife skills is shocking him. Mm. And this isn't, I don't blame tech or necessarily millennials for this. I think the origin of that blame lies in how many schools we've been getting rid of shop classes and the physical building classes. I mean, learning sewing in 1978 was super important to me. Mm-hmm. 79 in school in home economics. When you teach kids how to get their hands dirty and how to get them on stuff, it's a really important life skill to have. So in one sense, tech has moved everyone, like you're saying, we're so online and mm-hmm. we're all about that hot take. On the other end of the spectrum, it's never been a better time to be a maker because we are all weird in our teen years and we all have trouble finding our peer group. And online can help us find, no matter how strange our proclivity is, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, Russian space suits or Big Bird costumes, you can find a group of people that will help you fulfill your life goals with that. And that's amazing. And yeah, rapid prototyping, what was called rapid prototyping, 3D printers and laser cutters, is now moving heavily into rapid manufacturing. So these skills that digital natives are learning in hacker spaces and maker spaces at libraries and rec centers and other places around the country are real life skills they're learning. They're mm-hmm. learning the power of building from their creativity. And this is a drum that I'm beating heavily, because if we're going to make it out of this time, one, it will be because we've learned to listen to each other. But another is because we've taught a generation of digital natives how to use the technologies that we've invented for good. Mm-hmm. And I want to buy the next iPhone case that I get from a kid down the street who's built it in collaboration with me to my needs with his or her point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. kind of touching on that, what do you think are like some core things about being a maker that inform other areas of your life? Like, I mentioned earlier that I've always really admired your like deep curiosity about things.
Curiosity is super, yeah. super vital.
Yeah. Right?
And it's like, I often say, I don't care how someone becomes a maker, whether it's scrapbooking or knitting or making giant bronze sculptures. Those are all part and parcel of the same process to mm-hmm. me. And they all start with just being curious, usually about yourself. Curious about the things that you can't stop paying attention to, the way the light hits a certain thing on an architectural detail, or the way a piece of fabric feels or moves in your hand. Past that curiosity, I think another key one is sharing in community. Mm-hmm. To me, I've met a couple of singular creators in my life, but I think they're about as rare as hen's teeth. The rest of us have to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really powerful process. It took me a long... I also grew up with the myth of the singular creator.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very American cultural ideal, but it's a total myth. And so to me, that sense of community that can get built when you're sharing your enthusiasms with other people. Some of my closest friendships are just texting back and forth pictures of like cool stuff we're finding all day long.
Yeah.
And that's a really wonderful connection to find that someone, it's like when you're walking down the hall at Comic-Con wearing some costume you spent a year and a half or longer making, mm-hmm. and you run into someone else wearing the same costume, you don't think, they're wearing my dress. You think, oh my God, they've chewed on the same dirt that I have. Yeah. Come over here. Let's talk about what we went through together.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Savage Bills did really well, I feel, is like it illustrated this like shared just delight that everyone had when something went right. And I was thinking about that in like, I was like, there's no Gamergate equivalent in the maker community, right? Like, not that I'm aware of, at least. Oh. But I was like, I think that, yeah, that shared like,
there are plenty of shitty people harming or at least making the lives of female makers worse every single day. The female makers I know have all sorts of weirdness online, like any woman, yes. But luckily, I don't think we have a big, toxic, creamy center like Gamergate.
Yeah. What do you think makes women good makers?
I can't make that qualifier. I mean, you know, what makes a person a good maker?
Mm-hmm.
It's curiosity and generosity. I do think of making as an inherently moral act. Mm-hmm. I feel by and large, when you take your point of view and you recapitulate it through your body, through your hands or your voice or your ideas or your pen, you're participating in culture. Everybody has the ability to do that. There's nobody excluded from that. And sometimes the way in which you're recapitulating your culture has a resonance and it takes off like fire, and sometimes it doesn't. The creator can never have any control over that. But I, you know, for the longest time, I would get on Mythbusters when I would do public appearances, I'd get the question, how do you get little girl? How do we get more little girls interested in science?
Mm-hmm.
And I struggled with an answer because not being a little girl or having raised little girls, I don't mm-hmm. know. And then a female scientist I was backstage with was like, just get out of their way.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's exactly right. It's yeah. not about whether they're male or female. It's just mm-hmm. that every child is a natural scientist. They want to understand how the world works. They do control tests. They want to learn empirically by blowing that soda bottle up themselves. And they should, under parental supervision.
Yeah, I think that's really awesome. Do you find, for you personally, is the concept or the actual build usually the hardest part?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's hard to know. Sometimes the concept comes really fast. Like the Mad Max episode sort of came together really quickly once somebody in the room said, what about a Mad Max kind of melee challenge where, you know, it's not just a demolition derby? Like, oh, yeah, as we were talking about stuff that was adjacent to that. But the moment someone mentioned that, we were like, we were off to the races. Nitroglycerin was an easy episode to plan, but then nothing we planned went according to plan. And yeah. it was the hardest episode of all of them to shoot. It was such an ass kicker. For the ZF2, for replicating the ZF1 from the Fifth Element, I will say that was one in which both the planning and the execution were equally difficult and rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
That was my builder, John Marcoux, was the lead on that. And I mean, just having to find all these like really, really persnickety fittings to get some of these tiny air systems we had built into the thing to work. It was a lot of like deep catalog research to find these, like, got to go from this kind of fitting to that kind of fitting to get these pressures up. I'm sorry, I actually lost the plot of what your original question was.
The concept or the build, which the is hard.
You know, there is an aspect of sitting around the room with the production team and brainstorming ideas that is so deeply fun. And then really on almost every episode, it doesn't go according to plan. And it's figuring out where to go when it hasn't gone according to plan that might be my favorite part of making the episodes. Mm-hmm. Because you're in the field. You don't have the luxury of adding another day to the shoot. So you've got to figure out how to get an episode out of what you did. And a terrific example of this is Panjandrum.
Mm-hmm.
So Panjandrum was even though it was the second episode we aired, it was the first one we shot. And it ended with a failure.
Yeah.
And so that failure happened. And it's like 4:00. The sun is setting. There is no second run we can get that day. We can't come back the next day. The weather had been so bad in the beginning of 2019 that was like the only filmable day within a week on either side because of the rain down in Pacifica. And I thought, okay, so we have a failure. Wait a minute. This is going to happen at the very end of the last act of the show. And from this moment until the credits, maybe 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So the question really is not, can this episode sustain a failure? It's, can I and the team write this episode from here to 2 minutes from here in a way that the audience will be satisfied with?
Mm-hmm.
And that I thought, oh, no, that is an achievable goal. And so, frankly, we all kind of convened like zombies, like, wow, after all that work, that totally crapped the bed. And then we realized, no, we could just tell the story. This is what we're going to do. We're going to tell the story honestly. And mm-hmm. Adam Steltzner was totally on board because that's deeply scientific and engineering. And Discovery, to their great credit, saw the rough cut and was like, great, we love this episode.
Okay.
And I thought that they could have said, as you know, this happened on Mythbusters. There were times we turned in an episode where the ending was so not to the satisfaction that we actually found the money somewhere and reshot the end of the episode.
Oh, really?
That happened a couple times on Mythbusters. Cement truck, the episode, one of our most famous explosion, didn't end with an explosion, but the episode was so anemic that they paid for all of us to go back to Angel's Camp.
Emergency explosion.
Right, exactly. The emergency. It's a line item on every budget I have. The emergency explosion fund. The EEF.
Yes. The insurance, I'm sure, is a huge line item on every.
Luckily, I have no idea.
Yeah.
We use the same guy that we used all during Mythbusters, my friend Nick Plachet, who's third generation stuntman. His dad was Rock Hudson's stunt double.
Ooh.
Wow. Yeah. And Nick has been my consigliere and my trainer and my sifu in all of the stunt work that I have done over the years.
Nice.
And so what Nick does is he calls the insurance company for us and says, no, they can totally do it. He talks like a surfer. And he formerly did this job.
Gnarly dude.
Seriously. He's like, he talks like this, dude. They can totally do it. It's completely safe. Adam's a licensed safety driver. Nick formerly did this job for both Jackass and Fear Factor.
Ooh.
So he's very good at talking insurance companies into absurd things, into covering absurd things.
Savage Builds must be a real walk in the park after Fear Factor and Jackass. Jesus. So kind of on that same thing, like the design element mm-hmm. is especially for the VX2 or the
ZF2.
Yes. The AB7 for that one. You know, the design element is like so important too. How, like, have you ever really messed up a build with, like, at the end you're like, oh, I guess I shouldn't have gone with the camo or whatever?
No. So there are certainly early Mythbuster builds in which I realize now I have a lot more knowledge about how to produce something for camera mm-hmm. than I did in the early days of Mythbusters. So there are early experimental setups where I can't see what's going on, and that bothers me. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, like, I strive when I'm setting up a thing that's about to happen, like a gun's going to shoot into Iron Man armor. Every camera shot that is filming that, we work so that the whole story of what's going on in that shot should be visible.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we'll draw a target on the figure so that in that close up, you can see where something's supposed to happen. And that adds drama because will it happen there? In the wide shot, I'll add colored tape and signs to things so that when it flashes on screen, you're like, oh, right. Gun thing, target. Okay, great. I see where they are. I understand what's about to happen. So there are certainly early Mythbusters episodes before I had that knowledge, that skill to do that, and before the crew, you know, we all sort of learned that together,
mm-hmm.
That are too primitive for my taste. But on Savage Builds, like, you know, John Marcoux and Jen Schachter, the two main builders, both come with impressive aesthetic chops.
Mm-hmm.
And then my lead camera, Scott Sorensen, and the other camera, Willie Nail and Duncan Clark, are both, they're all so aesthetically oriented towards a cinematic look and mm-hmm. something that's really exciting. That part's the icing on the cake always.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most fun, is setting up the shots so that they tell the stories you want them to tell.
Yeah.
And then in the end of, like, trying to get my ZF2, which was twice as big as the ZF1, to look something like it.
Yeah.
That to me was like, I didn't know how well or poorly that would go. And once you start, it's like, wow, I've got 3 hours to get this done.
Yeah.
Because there's no more time to do it. So I'm just going to do the best I can do in 3 hours. And there are certainly things I might do differently if I had more time or more time to design it. But also, to me, the fact that it's not perfect, that it's really rough around the edges, that maybe my execution isn't perfect, is part of the way in which I'm also embracing the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm letting them see the imperfections and letting them join with me. And they might look at it and be like, what an idiot. And that's also fine. If that galvanizes them to want to do something, that's, I've done my job.
Yeah. There's some kid out there who's working on the AB7 3, whatever.
I hope not. It is terrifying having all of that weaponry available to just your two hands
yeah.
and one handheld device. That thing was scary to hold on to.
And you had a fire extinguisher strapped to your back.
It did, yes. Yeah, well, I had live gasoline yeah. and a flamethrower in my hands and a fire extinguisher on my back. Yeah.
What was the scariest moment filming this season?
Ooh. It was whenever nitroglycerin didn't yeah. go off. It's whenever it didn't go. Yeah, yeah. There's nothing scarier than nothing happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when nothing happens, who wants to go over there and see?
Yeah.
So there was one point during... It wasn't nitroglycerin. What was it? It may have been nitroglycerin. We were blowing... Oh, no, it was an Iron Man test. We were blowing something up, and one of the blasting caps didn't work.
Mm.
And so plastic explosives is made to be highly stable. You can set it on fire. You can shoot guns at it, and it won't go off. It requires a specific hypersonic pulse that it gets from a blasting cap. And sometimes from old blasting caps, they don't have enough juice anymore, and they'll go, pow! but the pow won't be enough to start the chain reaction in the plastic explosives. And that's what happened on site for us when we were out at the out on the bomb range. And the bomb techs had to put on a bomb suit and go deal with it. And the tension of that was super, super intense. They actually used our drone camera to fly in close to get a clear look to make sure that it was approachable. Mm-hmm. And once they surmised that it was approachable, they carefully went and made it safe. And then we reshot the sequence. But the series, like the, like I said, bomb squads are, and I are feel very simpatico. So there's a lot of jocularity on set. There's a lot of like, ooh, look at this picture of this thing, and you know, sharing stuff back and forth. And then the moment that happened, those guys dropped into a level of professionalism that I found really amazing.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. they were like, sure. Hey, Adam, we need you to stand behind this truck because this could go, and it's okay if we die, but it's not okay if you die. And I'm like, wow, that is a hell of a distinction to have to make during your day at work.
Yeah, that is. That
those guys are hardcore.
That's some, yeah, yeah. Also, if I was married to a bomb squad guy, I might be like, maybe look into a different 9-to-5. Can you teach yourself to let me phrase it a different way? Like, how can you teach yourself to be a better builder? Does it require literal like skills with a jigsaw or a bandsaw or whatever type of tool, or is it like better planning? What serves you best in like moving you forward and being a better builder?
What a wonderful question. Honestly, I keep coming back to community. It comes down to sharing your work with others and seeing it through their eyes. I think there's only so much you can do alone in a room. And I think that the perspective that I have gotten from other people about my work from the beginning of doing it, from being like 8 years old and drawing something and having an art teacher be. So I just remember my art teacher saying, today we're all going to draw something in class. Choose something to draw. And I was so not interested in this exercise. I was like, I'm just going to draw the wall in front of me. Like this was my F, not an FU, but like I can't think. So I'm just going to draw the wall in front of me. And mm-hmm. I drew the whole wall in front of me really exactingly mm-hmm. over the course of the period. And at the end, my teacher was like, wow, that's incredible. And I was like, really? Because I literally was drawing the thing I didn't have to move my head to see. But the feedback was they were right. This like 9-year-old kid did a fairly high fidelity drawing of everything on a wall, which mm-hmm. I now know is an impressive thing to see. That feedback is really delightful. And the feedback in which the way things touch people mm-hmm. when yeah. you make something and they look at it and they go, oh, wow. And they have an experience that you didn't. Mm-hmm. It more deeply informs and encourages. I mean, that's the other thing is when you share your work with others, you get back that encouragement, which is so important. And it, like, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask if you have favorite online communities or where what your go-to places are for sharing ideas.
And I do. I go. I'm a longtime, like 20-year plus member of the Replica Props Forum, mm-hmm. Which is I think about 15,000 to 20,000 different makers collecting props. And it's not just movie props. It could be stuff from television. It could even be stuff from history. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of spacesuit builders I've met on there, including my friend Ryan Nagata. There are other sub forums, like there's a Blade Runner forum whose name is, oh, Prop Summit. That's a Blade Runner forum.
I'm on that one.
I'm the moderator.
It's really great because not only are there like Blade Runner, there's Blade Runner posts, but there's then Blade Runner universe posts. Uh-huh. So it's not the movie particularly, but stuff that is canon or
extended
in-universe.
Blade Runner universe.
Oh, there's totally a Blade Runner universe. I also, it's not necessarily as much of a community in the traditional way, but I love Etsy. Mm-hmm. I love the way Etsy engenders conversations between the makers and the buyers. Mm-hmm. So I've met and commissioned and made many fruitful creative relationships with people on Etsy.
Oh, wow.
And I love that the platform encourages that. And it's so great to find someone whose work you like and to get them excited about making something they haven't made mm-hmm. for a project you're doing and like both of you learning together.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm into it. Yeah. I'm a fan.
I'm so obsessed with Blade Runner. I made the Blade Runner gun three separate times. Once at 18, once at 28, and again at 35. And when I was making the one at 28, I was living here in San Francisco in the Mission, and I was working in commercial special effects. And my best friend at the time told me just one day randomly, "Hey, I think this Blade Runner gun you're making is really neat. I think that's really cool that you're doing that." And this is a guy I talk to every single day. And yet the encouragement, that specific directed encouragement, was so powerful that I, like, forever after, I've taken pains to remember to tell people who are doing things I like, "I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
I support that entirely."
Yeah.
And it's like, I tell everyone else to do that too, because those little moments from the people we love, even though you think it's implied.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not necessarily implied. Mm-hmm. We all need to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm so nice. That's really, though, the thing that, if you guys haven't watched Savage Bills, it just ended. Last two episodes aired on Friday. It's all now available on Discovery.
They are all available on Discovery. They'll be re-airing on the Science Channel. And also, if you have Discovery Channel, you can watch it on the Discovery Go app.
Okay.
The entire run of eight episodes is available. We don't know if we've been picked up for a second season, but the moment I do, I will let everybody know.
Yeah, please do. But yeah, the thing that I really love about it is it does encompass all that, like, community and collaboration and expertise, and, like, in a very online world, it's so nice to have, like, this tangible analog kind of thing. And yeah, it really inspired me. I'm like, I want to be a maker. How can I be a maker?
You want
to
make a hot
sword
gun?
Swords will be
this
my
beautiful show every week. This is totally making.
Leah wants a sword.
Yeah, I want a sword, Adam.
You want a sword? Oh, okay. Gotcha. You want a radio sword.
I need something I can hold in my hand and say I did this.
We can totally do that.
But yeah, I just think it's a really, really beautiful piece of art that you put out in the world. And
you know, my friend Jenny Jordan from Boing Boing tweeted after the first episode that she felt like it was a we show, not a me show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also really gratified by that, because that was absolutely in art ethos.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do the one where you only ever saw one person building stuff. When I had such an amazing team working so hard.
Yeah.
Wanted to showcase that and bring them and wheel them into that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad it comes out and that it's inspiring. I couldn't be happier with this show. It's the best thing I've ever participated in.
Yeah. It seems really, really personal and joyful, and you guys should all watch it.
Yes. Everyone should watch it.
You'll clap, you'll laugh, you'll tear up. It's got it all. The full range of emotions.
It is also incredibly funny.
It is very
good.
Yeah.
Food fight episode, just a slow motion hot dog flying through the air. You won't believe how much I laughed.
What I really loved about the hot dogs is that when they hit Tori's chef whites, they leave this perfect little ketchup colored sphincter mark on his chef whites that is the end of a hot dog. It's like this little twink, twink, twink. We had my friend Drew Curtis's, like, 8-year-old daughter heating those hot dogs with a blowtorch on site.
All right. I hope JD Street was in the background supervising.
I'm sure someone was taking care of her.
That's awesome. But yes, please do go watch all of Savage Bills. It's a delightful way to spend some time and, yeah, get some inspiration about being a maker and trying to make the world better, guys. We all need it.
We do. Oh, my God. It was so much fun to come and talk to you guys about a show I made.
I know. Thanks so much.
Can we talk about Fleabag again, though, next week?
I was just about to say, let's just pivot to the Fleabag Hot Priest talk right now. So we have a few minutes left. But yeah, Adam, thanks so much for coming on. It was truly a delight.
Anytime, you guys.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Jess, do you have any last questions for Adam or anything?
I mean, do you have anyone you really hope to work with in season two?
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Yes, Jack White and I have talked about doing some kind of build together for a few years now. And
Jess is doing the hard eyes. emoji.
So I actually wrote to him about this series, and we weren't able to make the timing work. But and plus, he wanted to do something I wasn't sure was possible. I've now determined that what Jack wants to build is plausible.
Oh.
And if he's in, I'm going to do it for next season, if there is a second season. And if there's not, I'm going to find a sponsor and do it on Tested.
Nice.
So we will build, oh. Jack and I will build some. Jack is a maker. Like, he started out as an upholsterer.
Really?
Yep. And he's a tried and true, dyed-in-the-wool maker of things who loves getting his hands dirty. When we hang out, that's mostly what we talk about is power tools.
That's awesome. Speaking of, what's your favorite tool in your shop?
I love my lathe. It's a 3,000 pound chunk of steel that makes round things rounder. That's literally what it does. But with it, with that single machine, I could rebuild civilization if it collapsed.
Well, thank God.
Yes. Yeah. Just so you know, I've got one in my shop.
I'm going straight to your house. Well, straight to your shop, actually, when civilization collapses next week or so. All right.